What's up, y'all? I'm Will here with Schedule Fly, and this is the Restaurant Owners Uncorked podcast, one of the highest rated hospitality podcasts in the world, brought to you by us at Schedule Fly. We provide a very simple web-based restaurant employee scheduling software backed by legendary customer service. If you're on pencil and paper or Excel, or you're on some software with tons of bells and whistles and features you don't need or use, ScheduleFly is the perfect place for you. Easy to use, point, click, and go, and we'll take great care of you. ScheduleFly.com, free trial, check it out. Also, this podcast is brought to you by our sponsors, Pop Menu and The Giving Kitchen and Kickfin, and you're going to hear about them in just a minute. First of all, let's talk about today's guest. Hey, y'all. What a fun opportunity and a unique opportunity this was today to have Ryan Pruitt on the podcast. Ryan is at Pesh down in New Orleans, world-renowned, incredible restaurant. Been there 10 years, and 1 year in, Pesh won Best New Restaurant in the U.S. For James Beard. Ryan, that same year, won Best Chef in the Southeast. This guy's freaking awesome, and he's on his game, and I'm very fortunate to have been introduced to him by our mutual friend, Dave Query, another badass. So I feel so lucky to know both these folks. Ryan and I had just a wonderful conversation, and he's a really sharp, thoughtful, intentional, intelligent, caring individual who, it's no surprise to me, the success he and his team have had at Pesh. You're going to really enjoy this. If you've been to New Orleans, you've probably been to or heard of Pesh. If you haven't, you will when you go there. It's an amazing place. It's an iconic place. And this is a really, really good educational and inspiring conversation. Thank you all for listening. Thank you for watching. More coming soon. See ya. Give your team the gift of Pop Menu AI Answering, a simple solution for phones ringing off the hook. AI Answering handles calls 24/7, 365 days a year, so your staff can focus on in-person guests. Customize your greetings and responses, answer common questions, promote specials and events, and send follow-up links to ordering and reservations. AI Answering handles it all while escalating more complex conversations back to your team. Never miss another tasty revenue opportunity. Pop Menu, the marketing technology platform designed to make growing your restaurant easy. Discover more AI restaurant tools that turn your to-do list into an already done list by requesting a demo today. For a limited time, get $100 off your first month, plus lock in one unchanging monthly rate at popmenu.com. Go now to get $100 off your first month at popmenu.com. Be sure to tell them that Will from Restaurant Owners Uncorked podcast and Schedule Fly sent you. Y'all, this is a great business. I just told you what they like me to say. I will say that we have a lot of mutual customers at Schedule Fly with Pop Menu. They all agree. Great product, great customer service, great results. Check them out, popmenu.com. This episode is also brought to you by The Giving Kitchen. Giving Kitchen provides emergency assistance for food service workers through financial support in a network of community resources. Since its inception in 2013, Giving Kitchen has served over 15,000 food service workers and awarded over $10.5 million to food service workers in crisis. If you or someone you know is a food service worker in crisis, please ask for help. TheGivingKitchen.org, and again, that's TheGivingKitchen.org. Y'all, this is a phenomenal organization. Jen, the founder, has been on this podcast. Jen Heidinger Kendrick, check out that episode to hear their full story. But if you know somebody or you need help, go to thegivingkitchen.org. Incredible, incredible organization and very responsive and has a wonderful mission. Check them out. Ryan Pruitt, down in New Orleans, thank you for taking the time to join the Restaurant Owners Uncorked podcast today. Just do a quick introduction of yourself.
Sure. So my name is Ryan. Work with primarily with Pesh Restaurant here in New Orleans. I was born in Memphis, but have been down here in New Orleans for about 18 years, working in restaurants the whole time.
Yeah. See, I knew that's what you were going to do. You're like, my name's Ryan. I work in restaurants. I got this place called Pesh. What he's not saying, folks, is he's a total badass. He's a James Beard Award winner. His restaurant won a James Beard Award. I think like the same year, best new restaurant in the entire country. You won best chef. Was it best chef in the Southeast? Is that right? That same year?
Did. Yeah. We got it all out of the way at once.
Yeah, there you go, man. And our mutual friend, DQ, Dave Query, well, he probably have like 6 F-bombs in talking about how awesome you are, but he has said many great things about you as well. So
Dave is a generous man.
he is one of a kind. He is one of a kind. I love that dude. Okay, well, how did it all get started, man? We're going to take this conversation wherever it goes. I obviously did my research and I have things that I want to ask you about, but I mean, I always like to find out, like, here you are. This is your profession. This is your livelihood. You're clearly really good at it. When and where did it all start for you?
Yeah. So it started in San Francisco. So I moved there after I finished college, which was in Memphis. I got a degree in English, and like a lot of English majors, you know, I didn't know what to really do with it. So I went out to San Francisco to work in advertising. Did that for a few years, had some fun, had some good experiences, but ultimately it became clear that that was not the right path for me. So in the meantime, I had started spending a lot of time in farmers markets, spending more time in restaurants, cooking at home, trying to like teach myself how to cook, basically. So I spent a lot of time with books, a lot of times with the classics, and just working at home. And then one day, it hit me that I was in the wrong profession, and I left advertising and went into restaurants. So I started working in restaurants professionally for money in probably 2000 or so, 2001. And had a great run out in San Francisco, learned a lot, bounced around a lot. Learned from some really good people. Got to play a lot with the wonderful produce out in San Francisco and California. And I think the restaurant scene in San Francisco at that time was great. I got to really learn a lot really fast. And then at 2005, my wife, who was working in art nonprofits, decided she wanted to go back to grad school. We had sort of come to the end of our tenure in San Francisco. I think like a lot of people, we were in our late 20s, and I was working as a line cook and she was working for an art nonprofit. And we kind of looked around and thought, you know, we're never going to have any kind of actual life here. And so we looked around to cities where we thought that we really could put something together and where grad school programs for her looked attractive. We ended up in New Orleans after weeding out Manhattan and Austin. And it ended up working out great. Before we moved here, I got a job with my current business partner, Donald Link, at Herbsaint. So having a job is a great confidence booster to quitting your old job, which yeah. I did. And then we moved to New Orleans. We got here 4 weeks before Katrina.
Oh God.
So we hit the ground. I think I worked for about a week and a half, and then that was it. And then we were kind of spun out for a couple of months, but ended up coming back down to open Herbsaint with Donald. And then sort of went from there. We reopened Herbsaint in 2005. I spent many years there, ended up working my way up to the chef de cuisine there, went on to be a sort of very poor corporate chef for Donald and Steven Strajewski, my other business partner. And then we opened Pesh together in 2013.
Okay. So you passed in 2013, and then in 2014 you win this. Do you know you won this, like you won the top chef in the Southeast. The restaurant wins the best new restaurant. Like, did you have an idea that that was coming, or is this just all, I mean, do you act like, I don't know, is there politicking and advocating going on, or are you tied into the James Beard? Like, how does that all work?
Well, I mean, I think that's a complicated question, but the, you know, the, I would say that everything has politics attached to it. I think to deny that would to be to sort of, underestimate the role that connections and politics play in anything. But you know, for what it is, the Beard Foundation, at the time, it's a little different now, was a very, it was a peer reviewed organization, for lack of a better way to phrase it. The, so while the nominating committees could be people that you knew or had relationships with, once you moved past that initial point, you were subject to the votes and scorecards of all your restaurant peers. So at that point, it became in many ways more democratic.
Gotcha. Okay.
But it's a little different now. The sort of the way that the foundation has worked has shifted in the last couple of years.
Well, look, I mean, like I said, you know, you don't advertise this as you introduce yourself, but I mean, it certainly says whatever politicking and everything else aside, I mean, there's a massive amount of credibility and that comes with that. You, over a relatively short period of time, went from somebody just getting into the industry to very high level of accolades. It's interesting to me that you were in advertising before this and an English major, because to me, there's a common thread there, which is storytelling. And you know, when you're in advertising, you're trying to figure out how do I tell, I'm assuming, like the story of this brand, and how do I tell a story that connects with some audience? And it seems to me like the best restaurant owners and operators around the country, I mean, I think of somebody like Marwan Irani up at Chaipani, like just really good, and Dave Query, I mean, just really good storytellers, really good at conveying what you're doing, why you're doing, what you're all about, because that stuff, am I hitting on something, or am I just seeing things that are not there?
A really important point, you know, and I think a lot of times the trick is to sort of get out of your own way when you're trying to tell the story and not overcomplicate it. You know, I think one of the things that we always try to do with Pesh is to sort of under-promise and over-deliver, which has always been the mantra of a lot of the restaurants we're involved in. But especially with Pesh, you know, I mean, if you set the bar at we are a seafood restaurant, we are shining a light on Gulf produce, or sorry, Gulf products. And then people come in and they look around and say, oh, there's a lot more going on here. You know, it sets you up to really sort of craft a higher level experience for people. But yeah, you're right. I mean, the storytelling aspect is important. You know, I mean, that's trying to figure out who you are and what you're presenting to people is a big part of it.
And easier said than done. To do that well is challenging. Well, so when you, in your group now, you've got how many restaurants are in part of the Link group now?
So the Link group is, Cochon, Herb Saint, Butcher, Gianna, Pesh, and Boulangerie. And then there's an event space called Calcasieu.
Okay. Okay. Good deal. And you, do you have something you're opening? Do you have plans for this year?
You know, I'm not sure. I don't think so. To be totally honest with you, like the idea that there's sort of like there seemed to be a, especially in the pre-COVID era, there was this compulsion to constantly open new places and constantly be moving open restaurants out of town. And you know, we tried that. We worked on it for a little bit, but it didn't ever feel right for me or for us. And so like the idea that there would be another Pesh somewhere that we would try to expand the idea of Pesh just doesn't, I don't think it's in the cards. You know, I'm not sure that that I need to be moving on to new projects when there's such a big one that is so meaningful currently present.
I love that. And, you know, look, there was a lot of that because there was free money. I mean, you know, you borrow money for nothing. And so it just worked. There's probably an oversaturation of restaurants leading up into COVID. And this, that's kind of, I guess, you know, we're starting to see the other side of that now. Well, so, you know, there's so much changed during COVID for a short period of time. It seems like things are kind of getting back to where it's not quite as hard to hire people now. People are comfortable certainly going out now. I mean, what did you and the team at Pesh come out of COVID? How are you better from it, I guess is my question.
Yeah, well, that's a good question. You know, it really did upend the whole model for better and worse, I think, in a lot of ways. You know, I think for us, or for me personally, the most important part was that you were forced to immediately take stock of what you have, excuse me, and, you know, the very real threat of losing it all, makes it very a lot more important. And so I think going through that whole process, starting the restaurant back from scratch, you know, thinking about our relationships with not only the people that work in the restaurant, but all of our vendors and the people who provide us with fish and produce. You know, it's really hard to overstate how you had to, how all of that changed, and you had to sort of re-examine all of those relationships. You know, so I think for some people, the conclusion they got to was that the restaurant industry was not for them. And for other people, and I will put myself in this category, you know, I realized that this was exactly what I wanted to be doing, and making sure that a restaurant that we had put so much blood, sweat, and tears into was going to survive and be healthy, and that we could develop a new, or sorry, refine our model to make a better restaurant that has the legs to go, you know, forever for a sort of impossible goal. But, you know, it's always been my intention that Pesh is and remains a restaurant that can become part of the fabric of New Orleans. And, you know, getting back after COVID, I wanted to make sure that we had the opportunity to see that goal through. So, you know, it was a big gut check, I think, for a lot of people. Being on the other side in many ways now feels good, but the landscape is still pretty different. You know, I think New Orleans is in a pretty good spot. You know, we've got a lot of places that are opening, but we've got a lot of places that are closing too. So there's still some churn in the restaurant industry here. And I think a lot of that goes back to some of the sort of lingering scars of the COVID era. So, you know, I think one thing about the restaurant industry that's always struck me as both interesting and challenging is that it's always shifting. There is no real static point that you get to in a restaurant. And this is something that, you know, that we talk a lot about with the sort of managers, and especially with the ownership group, is that, you know, there's no hands-off approach to running a restaurant like Pesh. I mean, it's it requires somebody to be there all the time that has a higher level vision to keep something that big and that has that many employees and everything running. So, you know, all of that, I think, was really solidified after COVID, when we all looked around and we were like, you know, we need to double down our efforts. We need to reconcentrate on why we're here. We need to figure out how we're expressing our love for this business and this restaurant to the staff, and find out what other people think about it. I mean, are we off base? Did we create something that no one else gives a shit about? You know, I don't know. I would like to think that we didn't. But, you know, I think COVID forced you to ask all those questions. And I think that we've become a better restaurant on the other side of it. I think that we've become more thoughtful in the way that we operate. I think that all of those things are great. So, I feel confident about where we're headed, and I'm glad that we've sort of been able to survive over the last couple of years.
You mentioned being a part of the fabric of New Orleans. You know, that first of all, what a colorful and strong and amazing fabric that is.
Sure is.
Fascinating that you and your bride show up there right before Katrina and this happened, and you stuck it out. I mean, there's people that have been there their whole lives that have generations of family there that understood what New Orleans is and that it would rebound from that and it'll rebound from anything. It's an incredible city, a resilient city, a vibrant, strong city that's just so incredibly unique. I kind of think if I went down there and Katrina hit right after it did, I would have been like, man, I'm out of here without having that long-term connect. So you've obviously built that, and I'm going to imagine that your love for the city has grown intensely and immensely since then. You're bought in, you're there, you are a part of the fabric of that city. Tell me about just what is it about, I want to talk about hospitality, but I want to talk about hospitality in New Orleans, like, because it's a world-renowned place for that. Tell me what you think of when you think of hospitality in New Orleans and why what y'all do is an important, because it is an important part of the story of that city.
Sure. I mean, the hospitality industry here is huge. It's a significant employer for the city and for the area. I think that what has always struck me as being so interesting about New Orleans versus a lot of other cities is that so many of our customers come from elsewhere. So they're here, they're either on vacation, they're here for a conference, they're here for some other work-related trip. But regardless, they're coming here to have fun. They're coming here to enjoy what the city has to offer. And that's complicated. We all occupy a little sliver of that. It's the hospitality and the entertainment industry in New Orleans is wide and varied and complex. So for our small corner of it, at Pesh, the hospitality that I hope that we can provide is allowing people to come in and enjoy what is going on in the Gulf of Mexico. We're a seafood restaurant. That is what we profess to be. And when people come in, I want them to be able to experience the diversity and quality of the seafood that's in our area. I want them to be able to sit down and either have their meeting or escape if that's what they're trying to do. But as a restaurant, it's important to me that everyone feels welcome, that they're all there enjoying themselves. And I hope that we can continue to provide that experience at Pesh.
Tell me about the people that help you do that, your team.
Yeah, so we've been very fortunate. We have a lot of people that have been at the restaurant for quite a while. I think two areas of note that I have always been, that has always meant a lot to me is that, we have a lot of kitchen employees, particularly the management that has been there for a very long time, many years. And so the restaurant is a little over 10 years old. The current chef de cuisine, Nicole Mills, that runs the kitchen, has been there since the day we opened. Her sort of second in command has been there for 8 years. And then as you sort of move through the ranks, a lot of these people have been there for 5, 6, 7 years. And that means a lot to me. I mean, I think that that's, a testament to how we're trying to run the restaurant. And that's, not to say we don't have a lot of significant ups and downs. I mean, it's a complicated place, but it's very heartwarming to see people trust their careers like that to the restaurant. The second area that I've always felt really good about is our bar staff. You know, we have had our bartenders have been there forever. And you know, like the bar at Pesh kind of in some ways operates as its own little microcosm, its own little world up there at the front. It's at the very front of the restaurant. It was an addition to the historically an addition to the building. So there's a ceiling change. So it has this kind of slightly insulated quality to it. And I think what the bartenders have been able to craft up there, the regulars that they've sort of cultivated over the years, is also something special, and also a testament to the fact that they believe in the concept of the restaurant and what it means for them and their chosen career. So long story short, I have always felt very fortunate that we have been able to retain so many people for a long period of time at the restaurant. You know, and I hope that we're continuing on that path.
Fortunate, lucky, like any great leader, you deflect and you know, that's awesome. This is exactly the way I would expect somebody like you to answer that question. That comes because you and your team there have you clearly lead by example, and you clearly inspire people to want to be a part of what you're doing. Do you, is that something that comes, like, have you learned leadership? Have you read about leadership? Have you learned, like, who are the people that Donald and people that you've learned from? And I'm curious your style, because to have people that have been around a long time, Ryan, I mean, you clearly have a lot of great leadership qualities in yourself.
Well, that's an interesting question. I think that the you know, I think a part of my career that I've often been very thankful for is that I didn't have any really bad jobs in the restaurant industry. I started later in life. You know, as I was explaining earlier, I mean, I was in my mid up, you know, 25, 26 years old. I didn't start at, you know, 17, like so many people do. Right. So when I got into the business, you know, my intention was to own a restaurant, and my choices of jobs and employers were specifically made to work with people that I knew were going to help me get there, that were going to provide me with the information, the education, the skills that I would need to one day own a restaurant. And so, you know, I got lucky. I didn't have a lot of people that I was working for that taught me the wrong way to do things. I had a lot of people that were dragging me a lot of times and forcing me to do it the right way and be considerate of the way that restaurants and kitchens work, and be thoughtful in your conversations with people, and to always think about the big picture. You know, and so a big part of that has certainly been Donald, you know, who is certainly the biggest mentor in my life. And the thing, when I started working for Donald, he only had Herb Saint. And since then, you know, the sort of empire has grown pretty dramatically. And now there's around 500 employees, even in this post-COVID world. And I think, you know, being able to sort of see that entire process happen was also very valuable. And so, you know, you get thrown into positions that you might not be ready for, and then you have to be really thoughtful about how you act. You know, when I became the chef at Herb Saint, you know, I freely admit that I was not qualified for that job, and I've always been thankful that other people believed in me. And so it was very important to me to not screw it up, and to develop those leadership skills, and to the best that I could, so that I would, you know, I think to be blunt, fear of failure is a hell of a motivator. And
yes,
I think that's something that has always been, an important piece of compelling, me personally, to do the best that I can, both in my work life, personal life, everything else. Because I don't want it to go away. You know, I want it to be here forever. And I want people to enjoy what they do. And I want people to go on to experience the same enjoyment in the industry that I have. You know, so I think just all along the way, I've been fortunate to have good mentors, you know, the people that I have as trusted confidants. Dave is certainly on that list. A number of other restaurant people that I consider mentors are all people that I think would answer this question in a similar fashion, you know, where they're always looking around, you're always learning, you're always trying to be better, you're trying to adapt, you know. I mean, some of the best advice I ever got when I first became a restaurant manager is that you have to figure out why people come to work. You know, what is their motivation? Because, you know, for everyone, it's different, sometimes slightly different, but it's always different. And I think that simple advice has always stuck with me, because in order to provide people a quality job, a good sense of employment and development, you know, I think you have to try to figure out why they're there. And, you know, all of that and every other sort of skill has certainly been learned over the years from the people that I've worked for. So for anything that appears to be working, I thank all of the people that taught me how to act in a restaurant and also how to run a business. I mean, that's another important piece too. You know, you don't get to enjoy the restaurant life if the business is failing. So that's an important piece too. And Donald was always very, very good about that. You know, there's the restaurant, there's the food, there's the creative part, but there's also the business part. And we got to pay attention to both sides equally.
All right, y'all, it is time for a little mid-episode break. We're going to talk about Kickfin. Thousands of restaurants, bars, and breweries use Kickfin to tip out their employees instantly. No cash required. With Kickfin, tips go directly to your employees' bank of choice the second their shift ends. It's a really simple solution to a really big problem, because if you're still paying out credit card tips in cash, it's costing you. Time-consuming bank runs and cash counting take managers away from work that matters. Cash is hard to track, which leads to accounting headaches, and it creates the perfect opportunity for theft, human error, and compliance issues. Bottom line, there's never been an instant secure way to pay out tips until Kickfin. It's an easy-to-use software that sends real-time, cashless tip payouts straight to your employees' bank accounts, 24/7, 365. Kickfin gives managers hours back in their day, makes reporting a breeze, and protects your business from risk. Most importantly, employees love it. Restaurants can have Kickfin up and running overnight. Employees can enroll in seconds. No hardware, no contracts, no setup fees. Visit kickfin.com for a personalized demo. See how restaurants across the country are digitizing tips with Kickfin. All right, that's what they asked me to say, so I say it, and it tells the story very well, but I like to add this in. We referred a customer that we know and love very well, SupDogs, to Kickfin. SupDogs has been a customer for a super long time. Trust them very much with their opinion on these types of tools. They started using Kickfin. I asked Brett, the owner, recently how it's going. He said, Kickfin is perfect. It's going great. Exactly what we were hoping for. So there you go. Kickfin.com, y'all. Check them out. Well, you have a growth mindset, which is important, and you're a good learner, and there's luck. Anybody that tells you they've been successful and there's no luck involved is either, you know, they're lying or they're naive or whatever. There's always luck, but it's some portion of that. But there's also, you know, you clearly have a mindset of wanting to learn and grow. And look, Dave Querry, I mean, I love that dude. Like he's become a close personal friend. He's been a customer a long time. I first talked to Dave, it may have been 2009, 2010 was the first time I started doing interviews. And I'll never forget, he said, every day I know that this could all go away tomorrow. And so when you talk about the fear of failure, you know, like one bad night could just ruin the whole thing. And so that at the time I thought, I don't know about all that. Like, you know, but you know what? Then COVID hit. And then you know, it could go away tomorrow. So it's really interesting. But I know that it's funny you said that a lot of people would answer the question the same way. I mean, I could not agree more. I think he would answer that question the exact same way. How did you get to know Dave?
So we have people come and stage in the restaurant all the time, you know, and especially in the pre-COVID world, you know, people would come through New Orleans. They would want to work at a series of restaurants. You know, of course, we say yes to everyone. You know, I mean, if you're trying to increase your intelligence and knowledge and see some different food and you want to come hang out in the kitchen at Pesh, you're always welcome to do so. You know, I don't think there's any real secrets that you're going to be able to steal from the restaurant that aren't readily available. So we have people come in all the time. And so when Dave emailed me, I said he was coming to New Orleans and he was going to go work with Susan and Spicer and a couple other places and asked if he could come into Pesh. I just sort of absentmindedly said, yeah, absolutely. Let me know what day you want to come. And that's what it is. Anyway, day occurs. Of course, I'd forgotten about it. Wasn't really paying attention. And I walk in, you know, and I see clearly a grown man over on the grill. Working with our line cook, who's yelling at him to cut the green onions correctly. And so I'm like, well, that's kind of strange. You know, that's not the general type of person we see come in this kitchen. So I went into the office and Googled him. And I thought, oh, shit, this guy's got, you know, 20-something restaurants and is a major restaurateur in Colorado. And my grill cook is criticizing his green onions, you know? So I went out and talked to him. I was like, hey man, what's going on? Like I honestly, I didn't pay really any attention until now. How can I help you? So anyway, that was the kind of intro, but you know, then we got to be a little bit better friends. Dave invited me to come cook in his restaurants and Jack's out in Boulder and then in Denver.
Yeah,
which was great. So I stayed with he and Dana in their house.
Downstairs.
In the downstairs palace.
It's like I've been there multiple times. They have everybody stay in their house. Yeah, man, it's awesome. Good location.
all of it, you know, and you know, we got along really well. And you know, and then since then, over the years, we've definitely become closer friends. You know, he and Dana have a house here in New Orleans, and so we see them regularly. You know, I would say every few months, more frequently than I see a lot of people I'm friends with in New Orleans. I mean, Dave and Dana are just such wonderful people. I mean, we always have a good time together. I'll leave it at that.
I bet you do. Well, they're great people. Your industry has a lot of just amazing people, Ryan. And I know you know this. I didn't know that coming into what we do, right? So we've been doing this schedule fly thing for 16 years. I thought, okay, this will be a good business. I've worked in kitchens. I did stuff when I was young, but I was not a restaurant person. And when we started trying to come up with good content, I was really, that was it. Like we had a blog 13, 14 years ago. And there was like nothing to put on it other than like, we added this feature and it's like, who cares? And then I was like, well, what if we talk to some owners and like kind of summarize their story or whatever? One of the first people I was like looking around at our customer base. I was like, huh, this Big Red F group out there looks like they got something good going. I'll try to get in touch with this guy. And Dave was so kind and so generous. And we did this, you know, phone call. And I was like, what an amazing dude, person, business owner, chef, like member of his community. Like, I was just blown away by the guy. I really was. I was like, God, is this what most restaurant owners are like? And then I start like doing the, you know, I mean, we've done a couple of books. Dave was in the first one and we've done some video series and stuff and this podcast for all these years. And what I've come to learn is that there's just so many awesome people in your industry. I mean, they're hardworking, passionate, compassionate, thoughtful, intentional, kind, care about their communities, care about their customers, care about their staff. So I've just like totally fallen in love with the industry, you know, and just the people in this industry. A respect and admiration I did not have going, I'm very candidly didn't have going into this. And I've grown to just, there's so many people that I'm just consider friends now that I love. The industry is also, gosh, I mean, it's gone through so many changes in the last couple of decades. And one of the positive changes, I think, is, you know, you kind of had this work hard, play hard mentality, which created a lot of times this culture of like a you know, closely bonded, tight-knit family group within a restaurant. But the downside was the play hard part sometimes has led to mental health issues, substance abuse issues, and other bad actions. But the industry has started to really, I think, turn in a very positive direction around that. And you don't see that as much more. And you see people like, you know, do you know Steve Palmer Ben's friends? Like, yeah. You see these positive things that have come out of these negative situations in the past. And to your point that you said earlier, this industry just keeps changing and growing. And the cool thing is, it's just getting better and better in so many ways, I think.
Yeah, for sure. No, I would echo that. I mean, when you look at the quality of food just in any given town in America, you know, today versus 20 years ago, there's no comparison. I mean, you know, I think one of the things that's happened, you know, 20 years ago, you went to go work in New York, San Francisco, maybe LA or Chicago or New Orleans, and that was about it. And now, you know, there's hundreds of cities across America, if not all of them, that have somebody that's really out there trying to make good, high quality, personal, intentional food. And that's one of many ways that I think the industry has improved. I mean, you know, I think like everyone who's been doing it for a little while, you always kind of pine for those historical days and late nights. And, you know, I think the bonding aspect you pointed to was really meaningful for me. Was it sustainable? I mean, probably not. You know, and certainly not currently. You know, that is, I mean, I'm at a very different point in my life right now. And, you know, I will say that the people that are in their early 20s that work in the restaurants, I don't ask them what they do anymore, because I'm not sure that I want to know. But, you know, that was a fun time. And it was something I will always look back on fondly. Because for me, it didn't end up spiraling around into a mess that led me sort of down into a pit of despair, which it does for some people. So I think overall, watching the industry shift
for sure
to a world where we are more cognizant of these things, where we're cognizant of, you know, alcohol consumption, we're cognizant of work-life balance, not only, but for everyone in the restaurant, for the whole staff, and being more aware of people's needs. All of this is extremely positive and something that the industry has really needed to tackle for a long time. But, you know, I mean, of all the horrors that came out of COVID relating to the restaurant industry, I think that's one that we can count as a victory, that's a bigger part of the conversation now.
Yeah, work-life balance. I mean, but it's also a challenge too, right? Because people, the employees have different expectations now than back in the day. It was more, now it's, I want to work when I want to work, not necessarily when you tell me to work. Or that's a fairly common thing. So it's a little more challenging, I think, to find people that, you know, are loyal and want to show up and work hard and be a part of a team and take great care of guests. The opportunity with that is, if you can find those people, it is a wonderful, wonderful career where you're going to learn. I tell this to my kids. My kids are 19, 17, and 14. And I'm like, God, you know, working in a restaurant, whether you want to do this for your career, I've had my first two, and I'll have my third one probably next summer. He's 14. But you got to go work in a restaurant because you're going to learn so many life skills. You don't know it. You don't even know it when you're there, maybe. But the things that you learn working in a restaurant, in terms of balancing stress and dealing with this rush of activity and all this stuff going on and being able to keep your cool and keep guests happy and work on a team. I mean, the things that come along with that are so transferable, I feel like, to anything. If you can hold yourself and do a great job in a restaurant that's just packed and slammed and all this stuff, and then something goes wrong, and if you can deal with all that, then like a lot of other things are going to be a lot easier. Let's face it. Like most jobs are not nearly as stressful and challenging, and you know, particularly for like a 4 or 5 hour block of time is working in a successful and busy restaurant.
Yeah, no doubt about it. I mean, add to that the sort of crash course in interpersonal skills you will get working in a business that has people that come from all walks of life with all kinds of backgrounds and everything else. And yeah, I'm 100% for it. Like when my kids become, get to the working age, they will definitely be there for a little while. And then they can go pick what they want to do.
How many kids do y'all have?
I've got two boys. They're 10 and 12.
Ooh, okay. All right.
So yeah, they haven't gotten past rolling pasta yet, but we'll see. They'll get there someday.
No, you're still cool. That's the thing. Golly, man. My sons are 17 and 14, and I think even the 14-year-old one now, I'm not nearly as cool, but they go through it, but then they come on the other side of it. So it's it's part of the process. Do you for your work-life balance, what do you do for fun?
I spend a lot of time with my kids. I think one of the things that I've tried to do is, you know, I cook them breakfast every day, and I cook dinner most nights. And I think for me, getting my schedule to the point where I can do that was a big achievement, and something I'm trying to hold on to. I mean, all of that is subject to the whims of the restaurant, of course. But for now, I'm able to do that, which is great. Beyond that, it's just trying to be outside, trying to be on the water, trying to be somewhere that's not inside of the walls of a building, and any sort of activity that takes you out there.
Well, you got a lot of good activities outdoors down there where you are, man, for sure. Do you fish? Dave's a big fisherman.
I fish very, very poorly. I've been fishing with Dave a few times, you know, and luckily for me, the times that we've gone, we've had some pretty rough days. So he hasn't been able to show me up in the way that I know that he could. I like fishing. But, you know, more than anything, I love being on the water. You know, it's great out there. It's beautiful. It's everything about it. And that is one thing that we are really fortunate to have here in South Louisiana. Lots of water.
So an English major, do you read a lot still? Do you have time to read?
Oh man, I do. I am always embarrassed that I don't read more. I try to spend some time with it, and I try to spend a lot of time reading cookbooks and staying sort of up on what's happening in the food world. You know, I think that cookbooks were a big part of my culinary education. I mean, not going to culinary school and or taking that route. It was all people and books. So that's always been an important thing to me.
Yeah, man. What's sort of top of mind for you right now? Like, what is the main thing that you're sort of focused on going into this year?
Well, that's a good question. You know, I will say that I am not a resolution type of person, nor am I like a really sort of definitive, we got to get the goals set on January 1 to start achieving them as soon as possible. You know, I think that for a lot of people in the restaurant industry, getting out of the holiday season, getting through New Year's is one of the busiest times of the year. And so you don't really get to take a breath until a week or two after that, once all the dust is settled. But, you know, I think like a lot of restaurant operators, you know, my goals for the current year are frequently, or the upcoming year are frequently the same as the last year. You know, how do we get better? How do we pay people more? How do we make more money in the restaurant? How do we get better fish? How do we better tell our story to more people? How do we spread the sort of messages about Gulf seafood, about responsible seafood purchasing that we hold dear in the restaurant to other people in an effective way? You know, so one of the pieces that I've been trying to work on for years and we're getting a little traction with is getting a little bit more involved in the sort of seafood policy, fisheries policy, taking on some of the sort of bigger ideas and trying to educate myself in that world so that I can be in a better place to in turn pass that knowledge over to people in the restaurant to better inform how we make decisions. You know, what are we buying? Why are we buying it? Are we using all of it? Are we being as efficient as possible? Are we buying correctly from the right people that are doing it the right way? And you know, all of these things, which are, you know, sort of pretty surface level comments for a lot of restaurants, but I think things that are very meaningful to me and in turn to the people that are purchasing at Pesh. So, you know, every year we're forever trying to get better at how we buy and what we buy, and you know, we're subject to the whims of the marketplace, just like everyone else. But philosophically, working on that and trying to gain more knowledge in that world is always a perennial goal of mine.
What does that mean when you say responsible seafood purchasing? Like, what does that mean to you?
So to me, there's a couple of facets. Like one, you know, you're buying legal fish from American waters within season, like when they're meant to be fished. So that's a real surface level entry point. You know, the next step I think would be, who are you buying from and how are they catching and handling the fish? So do you have a direct relationship with this individual? Are you confident in and comfortable with their methods? And are you happy with the quality of the product they are consistently providing to you? And then, sort of one step above that is, have you created a financial system that works for everyone involved? And one of the conversations I have with all of our independent purveyors after we have established enough of a relationship for me to see that it's going somewhere is that we need to have a free-flowing dialogue about price and what is reasonable, because it is not my goal to drive the price down so that you don't want to work with us. And I want you to be able to catch the fish, and I want you to be able to make the money that you need to make. Of course, that's not an open checkbook policy. We have limits too. But to be honest, it hasn't turned out like that ever. You know, so I think those are the sort of three stages of being a responsible purchaser on a local Gulf level. So we try to incorporate that into all of our relationships.
Okay. That makes a lot of sense. Okay. And that's an evolving thing, and that doesn't change. And practices in all the things that your purveyors are, you probably help drive them to make their businesses better by having those conversations too, I'm assuming.
I mean, I hope so. You know, it's the system, the seafood procurement and transportation system only works if the dialogue is open and you are being very, very transparent about pricing, frankly. Mm. It's always concerned me that a lot of the, when you get into the whole sale market, a lot of the pricing becomes obscured. A lot of the sort of markups become very obscured. And I think one of the big challenges we have with wholesale seafood in America is the wildly different levels of pay for the same product as it moves through the system. So while a shrimper may get cents a pound for their catch, when it hits the sort of open market, so to speak, that may be a $6 a pound shrimp. And so, you know, people and everyone needs a cut along the way. I get that. Mm. But the way that it becomes so diminished when it gets back to the producer is a fundamental large scale problem in the seafood industry. And so, you know, I think when you're talking about goals, and I mentioned getting more involved in policy and things like that, that is what, you know, I want to focus on in a big way, is how, what's going on with the system? Why is it so problematic? Why do we see such attrition and people leaving the industry? What is within my power to do to help that situation, to help these people out and help it get better? You know, I had this really sort of powerful moment a couple of months ago when I was at a symposium about the tuna industry. So it was a long line tuna industry symposium. And what was interesting about this is that they brought in 13 of the, they're all men, they're all Vietnamese that run the long line tuna boats in the Gulf of Mexico. And this represents something like 80%+ of all the people that are running tuna boats in the Gulf of Mexico. And I looked around at these people and I'm thinking, these guys are all in their 60s. Mm. They're not going to be able to run these boats much longer. And they account for this huge percentage of the industry, you know, and they're running through all of their, it was really neat. They had a translator that we had headphones. They translated in real time between Vietnamese and English. You know, and you're listening to these guys talk about what's going on in the industry. And the thing that I kept thinking about is nobody's coming after these people. Like there is no one that's crewing these boats that are going to take them over. What does that mean for the procurement of tuna for future generations? You know, does it mean that it falls to foreign boats? Does it, you know, diminish the American supply? Yeah, I mean, there's 100 different ways to look at it. But, you know, after hearing that, it really hit home that, I mean, we are sort of perpetually, and this has been going on for a long time, but seemingly perpetually on the edge of a crisis with where all of the American seafood comes from. Now, my knowledge is mostly the Gulf of Mexico, so I wouldn't pretend to have any sort of deep knowledge about Alaska and some of the other big fisheries in America. But, you know, that's what we're seeing down here. And that's a big problem for me. And so one of the things that I really want to learn how to do is how figure out how restaurants can better affect this, how we can be better participants. And on my tiny level at Pesh, the way that we have decided we can be better participants is being more transparent about purchasing price and what we can pay and what we can't pay and what they need to make and all of these things. And you know, I like to think that we've hit upon a good system, but we're one restaurant. You know, we are not, our model is not going to fix the entire system. So learning more about that is something that is really important to me. And I think my career going forward.
Well, you got two young boys, gather them and all their friends and teach them how to go catch tuna, man. Like, that's an interesting thing. That's right, man. Well, you know, it's an interesting thing because that's just one example of hard work and hard labor that is aging out. It's not just, it's a general challenge, I think, in our country for a lot of different industries. And it is big challenge. It'd be not one that will be easily solved.
It's not.
But y'all are some creative sons of bitches, man. Y'all always figure this out. All the hospitality world is the most incredible industry for changing and evolving and figuring things out and being creative. And I don't know what the answer is, but it won't be easy, but y'all will figure it out, bro. I know it, man. you will, because you have good, hopefully you're not the only bright mind thinking about that. But it is. There's a demographic thing, and there's a generational thing, and hard work and labor is not maybe valued as much as it was, and I mean, you got about a decade away from that potentially. Just talk about something going away overnight.
Collapsing. Yeah. It's a real thing. But you know, I think there's ways that we can work on it. There's government and larger scale programs that can help people out. But you know, I mean, everything moves on a pendulum. I think the
I
restaurant
agree.
industry is particularly a particularly good example of this. I mean, I think during the Anthony Bourdain years, working in a kitchen was super sexy and fun. And then I think that we'll go through a period where it's, see you later. Yeah, you'll go ahead. I'll see you in a bit. I'll see you later. Sorry.
No, that's okay.
During the Anthony Bourdain years, you know, the restaurant industry was real, real sexy and real fun. And it really like had this sort of mystique to it. And I think some of the sort of shine is off the industry at the moment. But I think that it'll come back, you know, and I think that a lot of the, I mean, you know, a lot of these occupations, shrimping, fin fish, all that kind of stuff, you know, maybe it's not presented in the right way right now. And so people don't want to get into the industry. But that doesn't mean that it's always going to be that way. That doesn't mean that there's not a new way to sort of this so that people want to get into it and make it more profitable for people.
Yeah.
All that
yeah.
stuff. So we'll see what happens.
That's a healthy philosophy, and I completely agree with that, man. It yeah. does. Things go in waves. Well, look, I know you probably need to wrap this up. I wanted I will send you I'm going to send you a copy of this book for your reading pleasure as you look
nice.
To continue to grow Hospitality DNA. Some guys I know, Dave Nitzel and Dave Domzalski, wrote this book. It is fantastic. Neil Bodenheimer from Cure was in this book, it's really, really good. So I'll send you a copy of this. And I want to thank you, and I hope that I get to hang with you. I go to Boulder once or twice a year and I hang out with Dave and Dana. I've only been to New Orleans once or twice in my life in a previous career for work, in and out kind of thing. I've never been out able to really get on there and enjoy it and hang. And like, they're the best people to go do that with. So I'm going to try to cross calendars with them. And I would love to hang out at Pesh and get to meet you and just enjoy some time together sometime, man. Ryan, you are a kind dude and you're an awesome dude. And I appreciate you taking the time to do this and sharing your story and sharing all that's on your mind. And I hope that I get to meet you in person soon, man.
Yeah. Well, thanks for letting me be on your podcast. I really appreciate it. It's great to talk to you.
Absolutely, man. Have a good one, Ryan. See you.